why do you think she's connected? She is, well, she was, a historian specializing in early Christianity. If you had some Christian relics and they had real power, the next step to selling would be to establish their history and provenance. Stella knew about the relics. How? Stella grinned. I would imagine she went to college, maybe for many years. How did you know about the connection to the Christian relics? Alleged Christian relics. The Christian relics Pastor Haywood may have authenticated, those Christian relics? I would strangle her in a minute. I sat down at the table and smiled at her. My patience is an infinite lake. Feel free to drown yourself. There were times when ancient proverbs came in handy. You are no fun. I'm here to help, like a colleague or a partner. You screwed up and got sent to Atlanta, because that's where the Order dumps troublemakers with potential, those who don't follow orders. This is the end of the line if Nick can't... I paused, looking for the right word. Rehabilitate you. Except both times I came to the Order, you were there, in the middle of the day, at your desk, instead of being out working a case and making a difference. Nick is keeping you on a short leash. It's killing you. And here is a high-profile murder that none of the other knights are working. You saw it and you jumped on it. So you didn't come to help me. You came to help yourself. Stella looked at me for a long moment. That, and I don't trust you. Also, I'm bored. How did you find out about the relics? Nick sent me to the Methodists to check on the boy. While I was there, one of them handed me a list of relic hunters to pass on to my colleague. He also mentioned that there were two historians in North Georgia who specialized in consulting on relics, and Alicia Walton was one of them. And Stella had put the rest of it together. Smart. She would be all over this murder, except Nick had surrendered this case to me, and she probably didn't have authorization to investigate things on her own. She needed me. Can I have that list? She passed me another folded piece of paper. I opened it and scanned the six names. None of them looked familiar. How is Douglas? Who's Douglas? The little boy. Stella grimaced. They said they are doing all they can. Whenever I heard that, things turned out for the worse. Do you want to see this crime scene or not? Stella asked. I'd love to waste more time, but if we don't hurry, the cops will cart the body off. You mean this is a recent murder? When exactly did this happen? It was reported about an hour ago. Were you going to tell me this at some point? I just did, but if you want, we can keep trading barbs in your charming kitchen. Wait for me outside, please. I got out of my chair and went to get my horse. 30 minutes later, Stella and I stood in front of Henry L. Bowden Hall in the heart of Emory University. The three-story building loomed in the dark, dimly illuminated by a row of fay lantern street lamps, and the ghostly blue light gave it a foreboding air. When we arrived, two policemen, armed with shotguns and swords, guarded the entrance. We had shown them our badges, and one of them went inside to let the lead detective know that we were there. We'd been standing around for 20 minutes, waiting for the PAD to finish processing the scene. Supposedly, we'd be allowed in once Biohazard said it was safe. The building was older, pre-shift, with the first floor sheathed in pale stucco and the two upper ones inlaid with polished stone tiles, marble or granite, I couldn't tell in the dark. All three floors sported rows of rectangular windows, 3 feet wide and 6 feet tall, shielded by thin metal grates. Half-inch steel bars, only two crossbars, cheap-looking steel without any trace of silver. Protection on a budget. To make things worse, the grates opened like shutters, so the top and bottom edges of the grate weren't anchored. The entire mess was secured by four bolts on each side, driven into the wall. Do you want magic monsters in your office? Because this is how you get monsters in your office. I was pretty sure Alicia Walton hadn't wanted monsters. The grates aren't properly anchored, Stella said quietly. It's a college. So? They have a limited budget. Stella rolled her eyes. The academy is a college and it has proper grates. She wasn't wrong. Let's take a walk around the building. We turned left and followed a paved path around the corner, rounding the building. The Woodruff Library sprawled to the left of us, cushioned in trees and steeped in deep night shadows. You could hide a dozen wolves in those shadows, and using my magic to send out a pulse and check if they were there was out of the question. I didn't know what Stella's special tricks were. The less she knew about me, the better. Moonlight cascaded from the dark sky, illuminating the side of Bowdoin Hall. A hole gaped in the top row of windows, second from the left, emanating a faint cerulean glow. The steel grate that used to shield it stuck out of the hedge bordering the path. The corner of it jutted up, with the bolt still attached to the hinge. You get what you pay for. Deep gashes marred both sides of the windows. Those are claw marks, Stella said. She held her hand up, sizing them up. Big boy. It had trouble fitting through, I murmured. We stared at the window. There were no claw marks on the wall, no tracks on the lawn on the other side of the path either. It didn't run up and climb the building. It had to have flown. A manticore checked some of the boxes, winged, large, carnivorous, fangs. You could probably train one to attack on command. But they were smaller, and they hunted in packs at dusk, swooping down onto the running prey. They rarely attacked humans. Their preferred targets were deer and herds of feral cattle. There's one thing I don't understand, Stella said. Yes? Why did you decide to live in that death trap? Really? Here we are at a murder scene, examining the claw marks of the perpetrator, three stories up and in poor lighting, and your mind is laser-focused on the mystery of my house. Truly, Knight Davis, no detail escapes your notice.
I like to know things. It doesn't make sense.
I like to know things, too. Like, what did you do to get shipped off to Atlanta? Stella raised her chin.
I punched a superior.
Somehow it didn't surprise me.
How superior?
Stella pondered the question. In terms of rank or morality?
Hey, the cop called from the entrance. You can go up.
We went up the marble staircase to the third floor where a hallway stretched, interrupted by doors on both sides. Brighter fey lanterns, fastened to the walls, bathed the corridor in sharper light. At least I could see where I was putting my feet. One of the doors on the left, almost at the end of the hallway, stood wide open. Two people waited by it, a middle-aged white woman in a PAD uniform and a black man in his mid-30s in a suit and tie. Two others, wearing white coveralls with PAD biohazard units stenciled in red on the back, crouched on the floor by a portable M-scanner. Biohazard's official name was the Center for Magical Containment and Disease Prevention, but it was confusing, while biohazard was clear and familiar. Whenever someone reported a freaky, life-threatening magic incident, biohazard would race there, secure the remains, process the scene, and sterilize the site. They were the city's magical CSI, and the first line of defense between it and magical hazmat. The detective waved us over. He had one of those weary faces that told me he was used to being woken up in the middle of the night to examine the bloody end of someone's life. For the survivors, the murder of a loved one was the worst thing that ever happened to them. For him, it was early Tuesday morning. Veteran mercenaries and soldiers sometimes looked like that after decades of fighting, except he was barely in his 30s. He gave us a quick look.
Badges? Stella and I held them out. What's the order's interest in this case?
We believe it's connected to an ongoing investigation, I said.
Which one?
Telling him about Pastor Haywood would catapult this into high-profile territory. Two things could happen. First, they could hand this murder off to us, the way they gave us Pastor Haywood. Second, far more likely, The PAD would want to hold on to this murder and request any findings from us because the two cases were connected. That would allow them to benefit from my investigation while keeping an eye on the order. There would be a lot of red tape, meetings, and, in the worst-case scenario, a joint task force, which I needed like a hole in the head. I'm not at liberty to say. Our findings are not conclusive at this time. The detective's look communicated that he wasn't born yesterday, that he knew I was dodging, and that he wasn't impressed.
I'll allow you into my crime scene as a courtesy. Don't cross the chalk line. Don't touch anything. You have 5 minutes.
Before we go in and the countdown starts, Stella said, who found the body?
The cleaning crew, the detective answered. They work nights because of the heat. The custodian was taking out the trash around 10:30, noticed the broken window, and came to check. He knocked, Professor Walton didn't answer, he unlocked the office, and here we are.
Any witnesses? Stella asked.
No. Graduation was on May 11th, and the summer session doesn't start until June 1st. The campus is deserted.
Thank you. I stepped into the room. Stella came in right behind me. The office was a rectangle, and if it were drawn on paper, the door would be in the right bottom corner, by the wall lined with bookcases brimming with volumes and binders. Next to them, a man in his early 20s waited with a bored expression. Bronze-skinned, with big brown eyes and short black hair, he wore the white biohazard coveralls. A patch with stylized flames marked his left sleeve. A firebug. A pyromage, in case the body rose, grew fangs the size of steak knives, and expressed a desire to eat human faces. The broken window was in the wall opposite the door, about midway, its frame scarred by deep claw gashes and stained with smudges of blood. Something had really dug into the wood, trying to squeeze inside, and then left the same way it came in, smearing the blood of its victim in its wake. Shards of glass from the window littered the floor and the imitation Moroccan rug. In the center of the rug, Alicia Walton's corpse lay in a crumpled heap, staining the beige carpet fibers a gory burgundy. Her head, a wet red mess, rested against her right shoulder. The killer had bitten through her neck from the left, nearly severing it in one bite, and leaving the head attached only by a narrow strip of skin and flesh. Her white blouse and shreds of her bra hung off her body, blood-soaked and torn, and her chest cavity gaped open, the broken shards of ribs slick with dark blood. More blood colored her khaki capris. Someone, probably Biohazard, had drawn a protective chalk circle around the rug and the body. Standard procedure. The chalk would delay the reanimated corpse long enough for the firebug to torch it. I approached the circle to get a better look at the body. No heart. Only a puddle of dark blood pooling inside. The blood was still liquid. Once the heart stopped pumping, the blood settled within the lowest points of the body due to gravity, turning the skin an ugly mauve. The process was called liver mortis, and it started anywhere from 30 minutes to 4 hours after death, reaching its most pronounced stage in about 12 hours. Alicia's body showed no signs of it. She was killed a couple of hours ago at most. The creature had come through the window and attacked her right there on the rug. All the blood was confined to it. It likely bit her neck first, knocking her down, then straddled her and broke open her chest to get at the heart. Past the body, almost all the way at the other wall, a large desk waited, with an office chair pushed back from it, but still upright. Two smaller chairs lay overturned against the desk. I blinked, and the office blossomed into colors. Gossamer tendrils of the palest gold bordered the window, stretched in thin lines across the floor, then exploded over the body into a familiar cascade. No other strong magic signatures, just assorted blue traces, old and faded, likely left by students or other visitors to the office days ago. I blinked it off. The same creature that killed Pastor Haywood murdered Alicia Walton. Both of them likely handled the same item. The Christian artifact had a guardian.
It was an established practice in the ancient kingdoms. I'd come across it once before, and I had been taught how to do it in case I ever needed to protect something of significance. If you had enough power, you could bind a magical beast to an object you wanted guarded. Once bound, the object emitted magic that only the beast could feel, and anyone who touched it would be stained by it. The guardian would track that stain until it killed the thieves and retrieved the object or died trying. The old myths were full of such stories. The dragon watching over the golden fleece, the Spriggans guarding Fey treasure, the Pixiu who craved the smell of gold and secured it in the homes of their masters. Both Pastor Haywood and Professor Walton had touched the artifact, and the guardian had punished them for it. It probably couldn't get to the artifact itself, or the thief who owned it now. Whoever it was either knew about the curse or was very lucky. Now the Mavir's confession made sense. He said that Malak wanted Pastor Haywood's killer. The artifact wasn't important to Malak. The divine beast guarding it was. Why? If I got my hands on the artifact, the beast would come for me. I had to find this magical trinket. Selling an artifact required 3 people, an expert to assess its magic, a historian to trace its provenance, and a broker to calculate its value and facilitate the sale. The magic expert and the historian were dead. I had to find the broker. As long as I had the broker, the guardian would come to find them, and the Mavarim would follow. Why was she here late at night alone? Stella wondered.
Working on a book, apparently,
the firebug said. Steps echoed down the hall, someone walking toward us, briskly. I surveyed the scene again. The more I could figure out about the artifact's guardian, the better. How old was Professor Walton? I asked.
40s,
the firebug said. No cane? No mobility problems?
If she had a cane, we didn't find it.
What are you thinking? Stella asked. I carefully walked around the circle to the desk and stood behind it. I could see both the door and window. The desk had been positioned to enjoy the view of the woods. About 12 feet to the door? Stella nodded. Give or take. I pointed at the window. A giant flying creature tears the grate out of the wall and tries to force its way inside. It's too big, so it claws at the window frame, trying to wedge its way in. You're a 40-year-old college professor sitting behind this desk. Your next move?
Run for the door, the firebug said.
12 feet. Stella's eyes narrowed. She should have made it.
She jumped out of the chair, the firebug added. It's pushed back. But then she didn't run.
Why wait? I thought out loud.
Maybe the creature has some sort of hypnotic magic gaze? Stella said. But she jumped out of her chair and came around the desk, the firebug said. If there was some sort of hypnotic gaze, she would have stayed seated. If it was me, I would come around the desk so I could fry its ass without damaging the furniture.
Maybe Professor Walton had some sort of offensive magic we don't know about, I said.
She didn't, a new voice said.
A stocky white man stepped into the office. He appeared to be in his early 40s. His tousled dark hair stuck out from his head in all directions, as if he'd rolled out of bed and hadn't even bothered to drag a comb or even his hand through it. A pair of wire-rimmed glasses perched on his nose. He wore khaki shorts, work boots, and a blue t-shirt with a pointy hat printed in white ink. The words below the hat said, "Keep calm, I'm a wizard." The firebug stopped slouching and stood straight, suddenly looking alert and professional. Crap, Stella muttered. Luther Dillon. When I left, he was a higher-up in Biohazard. Whenever Kate had to report something to them, she called him first. I'd met him a handful of times, twice because Kate asked for my help with a crime scene, and on a few occasions at family gatherings, like Kate and Curran's wedding. All I remembered about him was that he called Kate a heathen and pretended she bothered him, while helping her in every way he could. And he was brilliant. On the recognition danger scale,
he ranked pretty low. Luther gave me a cursory glance and focused on Stella.
"Knight Davis. Assistant Director Dillon." Stella squeezed through clenched teeth.
"I didn't know you would be here." She winced as soon as she said it.
"I'm a wizard, Knight Davis. We are always exactly where we're supposed to be. You, however, are not where you're supposed to be. I was wondering who was cavorting around my crime scene, asking smart questions, and imagine my surprise when it turned out to be you."
Uh-oh. Luther crossed his arms.
"Do you remember the song I taught you last time you interfered with one of my crime scenes?"
Stella looked like she'd swallowed spoiled milk.
"Yes." "Splendid. Let's sing it together. I'll start. Biohazard is a law enforcement agency. Yes, yes, yes. Your turn."
Stella unlocked her teeth. "The Order is not a law enforcement agency. No, no, no.
All the crime scenes in Atlanta Metro are mine, mine, mine. All the crime scenes in Atlanta Metro are yours, yours, yours."
Stella intoned.
"When are you allowed into one of my crime scenes?" Luther continued. "When I'm personally invited, invited, invited."
Wow. What did she do to make him that mad? I'd never seen him like this.
"Knight Davis," Luther said without any trace of humor, "were you invited to this crime scene?"
"No."
"Begone, ye unfortunate."
Luther pointed at the door. Stella headed straight for it without another word, and I followed. We walked down the hallway with Luther about 20 feet behind.
"What did you do?" I whispered.
"Later," Stella ground out.
"No, no, Knight Davis," Luther called. "Don't be shy."
Stella shut her eyes for a second. "We were working a murder case jointly. Several people died standing up with strange bulbs growing out of the bodies. One of them came to life. And in blatant violation of the safety procedures established over the last 4 decades, Knight Davis didn't give way to the pyrokinetic specialists. Instead, she had a lapse in judgment."
We turned onto the staircase and headed down.
"I hit the corpse with a sword," Stella said, her tone resigned. "It exploded. And because Knight Davis was in the way, the explosion couldn't be contained in time."
"What do you mean, exploded?" I asked.
Stella grimaced. "I mean its insides suddenly and with great force became its outsides. People got splattered. Nobody died."
Luther's voice held no mercy.
"Nobody died because they were in the ICU for 5 days receiving cutting-edge medical care. Many of them wished, loudly, that they had died, and some even asked us to kill them. And this is why this particular Feldman minion is not permitted at any of my crime scenes."
"Okay, then. Stella, did you get sick?" I asked.
"I don't get sick. Ever."
"Accurate," Luther called out. "She was covered in gore. Some of it even made it into her mouth. She didn't have a single symptom. No agonizing pain, no projectile vomiting, no bloody diarrhea. Fresh as a daisy."
"You really don't have to walk us out," Stella said.
"On the contrary, I really do."
We ran out of stairs and the big double doors loomed in front of us. Stella and I opened them at the same time, she on the left and I on the right. 10 feet away, in a pool of light from the nearest Fay Lantern street lamp, stood Nick Feldman.
Oh, shit.
Nick looked like a statue from Easter Island, whose eyes were on fire with ice-cold fury. Stella turned and tried to go back inside. Luther blocked the doorway and shook his head.
Nick's voice was ice cold.
"Knight Davis."
Stella turned and faced him.
"Yes, sir."
"Follow me."
He turned and marched down the path. Stella sprinted after him.
I halted.
Nick was having a terrible night. I wasn't sure if Stella would survive. Should I go and try to explain? I could lie and say I dragged Stella here, but then he might get angrier that a complete stranger somehow convinced her to disregard his orders. That would make it even worse. Luther came to stand next to me.
Well, someone is in trouble.
I didn't answer. It wasn't a question, and sometimes silence was the best strategy.
Ms. Ryder, if I could borrow you for a moment.
I pivoted to him.
Of course.
Luther glanced at a red-haired woman holding a set of keys who stood by the door.
Could you please open the library for us?
The woman nodded, her expression shell-shocked. Luther waved at one of the uniformed officers and started down the path toward the library. The three of us trailed him. The woman unlocked the library, Luther thanked her, and she rushed back to Bowdoin Hall. Luther looked at the cop.
Stand by the door. Nobody comes in. If an emergency happens, they wait outside. You come and get me.
Yes, sir.
Luther turned to me.
Okay, then. Let's find a comfy spot and chat.
We headed deeper into the library. The moonlight spilled through towering floor-to-ceiling windows, and our steps sounded too loud in the empty building. The campus clearly didn't take security too seriously. You could drive a pack of manticores through those windows. Luther found a group of couches by the window and landed on one of them, indicating another with his hand. I sat. He studied me for a long moment and smiled.
Love the new face. Have you told the Lennarts that you're in the city, or should I be the one to break the happy news?
I opened my mouth. Nothing came out. Of all the potholes to walk into.
Luther chuckled. Take your time.
How?
As a sensate, you see the nature of magic and the traces living beings leave in their environment. I perceive the specifics of one's magic, but only when I meet them face to face. To me, everyone's power has a unique signature.
He had remembered me. I must have been special enough to commit to memory. When we'd first met, he'd accused Kate of holding out on him because she had a sensate all this time. I should have asked myself how he'd identified me. I shouldn't have forgotten this. A blunder.
I never forget a magic face.
He tapped his temple.
You've evolved. There are layers and layers of power wrapped around your core, but that core remains the same. I remember it from years ago when I first met you. You are still you.
He had no idea what those words meant to me.
Did I say something wrong?
He asked gently. I have lived through so many versions of me. I don't even know who I am anymore.
This is life, Luther said. We change, we alter ourselves, we grow or shrink. It's part of the human condition. You might have altered your identity, but when I heard you think through the scene, you sounded just like Kate. She always had good instincts, and so do you. Hold on to that.
Huh. I was still me, and me sounded like Kate.
Thanks. You're welcome.
I would need to watch my speech patterns around people who used to know me.
Would you mind letting me see your full power for a moment? The cloak is obscuring things.
The cloak was supposed to obscure things. That's why I had painstakingly crafted it and practiced maintaining it until it became second nature. If I let him see my magic, he would learn way too much about me. If I kept hiding, I would shatter any hope of him trusting me. I needed his trust. I had to convince him to keep my secret. I met his gaze.
There is a reason I haven't told my family I'm here. I'll explain why, but you have to promise not to tell them. So I would know something the Lennarts don't?
Luther smiled.
My lips are sealed, pending the explanation.
I dropped the cloak. Luther became completely still. We sat quietly, looking at each other. When Era helped me to unlock the reservoir of magic inside myself, she told me I shone like a star. And then she made me promise I would never show it to my grandfather. Luther came too, as if waking up, cleared his throat, and reached for me.
May I?
Yes. He gently took me by the chin, leaned forward, and examined my face.
Fascinating. What happened?
Transmogrification through magic assimilation. I took someone else's body part and had to incorporate it.
Incredibly risky, but it clearly paid off. Was it an eye?
Yes.
Physically, they look identical, but the concentration of magic in the left eye is much higher.
Luther nodded and sat back.
Beautiful shade of green. The pain must have been excruciating.
It was.
How long?
About 2 months, and then I went into a magically induced coma for another 9.
I'm amazed you survived.
Luther leaned forward, his eyes alert.
What possessed you to do a thing like that?
Fear. I reinstated my cloak.
An excellent motivator. Tell me more.
Are you familiar with Moloch?
A Canaanite god, the unpleasant kind, famous for his dominion over fire and a fondness for child sacrifice. As I recall, he prefers his offerings to be burned alive. There is some murky water around the interpretation of the name.
It's not a name. It's a title. It means God King. It was used by hereditary rulers who descended from Sidun ibn Canaan, who founded the city of Sidon over 7,000 years ago. They ruled the people who later became known as the Phoenicians, and their kingdom stretched over modern Israel all the way to southern Jerusalem.
Roland's contemporaries, Luther grimaced.
Not exactly. Moloch's reign officially ended during the time of Roland's grandfather. He was the last of his line. In the ancient age, wars could be decided by a single duel between powerful magic users. The rulers of the countries were expected to take the field and defend their land and their people. They went to great lengths to augment their powers. For my adoptive family, that meant dealing with Shar, an irresistible urge to claim and protect land. Moloch paid a different price. Moloch's family feared death, I told Luther. So they focused on regeneration. They wanted to become unkillable, and when their natural magic wasn't enough, they reached for divine power. They allowed themselves to be worshipped as gods.
Luther frowned. Divinity comes with a big price tag.
All living things generated magic, but humans, with our intelligence and emotions, were particularly adept at directing it. Human thoughts carried power, especially when blended with emotion, and few things were more emotional than a prayer. Each plea to a god sent him a portion of the human's power, especially when it was spoken aloud. Together, the faithful powered up their deities like charging up a battery. The bigger the congregation, the greater the power. In theory, it was limitless. But Luther was right. The arrangement came at a heavy cost. And that's why Moloch's kingdom fell, I said. He became a god, obsessed with accumulating power through sacrifice and prayer. He lost his grip on the physical world. Normal human needs and urges no longer troubled him. He let his ancestral kingdom be conquered and carved into pieces. As long as the invaders worshipped him, he didn't care.
Abandoning humanity wouldn't have been much of a stretch for him, Luther said. Once you decide that burning tiny humans alive is a perfectly acceptable method of upgrading, you stop being human. Made the transition to godhood that much easier.
I nodded. I'd seen the inside of Moloch's citadel up close. There were no words to describe that kind of suffering. I hadn't known human beings could endure that much pain and despair. After the magic civilization collapsed and tech flooded the world in waves, Moloch should have faded away like other ancient gods without a persistent mythos. But he got a boost from the Old Testament. He's mentioned 5 times in Leviticus, once in 2 Kings, and once in Jeremiah, not counting the allusions in Deuteronomy and Ezekiel. Sometime during the Middle Ages, Christians became a bit obsessed with him, and he made the transition to demonhood. Luther sighed.
Christianity, the most composite of all religions. Why let a rival god, even a small one, die when you can turn him into a demon and rummage through his rites and holidays for the bits you can savage to attract his worshippers?
Exactly. After the first shift, magic hadn't disappeared completely. It dropped too low to be useful, but it was still there. Every time Moloch's name was mentioned, he got a crumb of power. That trickle kept him alive like an IV drip to a coma patient. Then the second shift flooded the world with magic and delivered a shot of adrenaline to Moloch's power reserve. He hoarded it, biding his time, until he had accumulated just enough. 4 flares ago, Moloch chose to be reborn.
Luther leaned back. An avatar?
Yes.
Flares drop every 7 years, which would make him in his mid-30s. Plenty of time to build a power base.
He has a citadel in Arizona. He is practically indestructible. I dismembered him, cut off his head, and threw his body into his forge, and he popped right back up in less than 2 years. Near-perfect regeneration isn't his only trick. He is almost impervious to fire. He wields it like a weapon, and he's highly skilled in metallurgy. He overlaps with Hephaestus in powers, and he is taking full advantage of any stray Greek neo-pagans that come his way looking to serve a god with a forge. A shadow passed over Luther's eyes.
Why Arizona?
Metallic mineralization belt. He mines copper, gold, silver, lead, and zinc. It gives him access to some iron, but also tungsten, peridot, and azurite, which he uses to create enchanted weapons. He's building an army. Also, the area he's in is mostly empty and hot as hell.
Ha ha, I get it. Hell as in Tophet,
Luther said.
The Levant is a rather crowded place right now. You can't swing a sacrificial lamb without hitting some old god.
He wasn't wrong. Any of the fertile regions where ancient civilizations had flourished were becoming hotly contested territories when it came to deities. By contrast, the continental U.S. was a vast and relatively sparsely populated area, especially since the shift had decimated the population across the board. A lot of areas had fallen to the wilderness, a perfect place for an avatar to hide and quietly grow his power.
Luther rubbed his chin, thinking. So Moloch has free rein in Arizona? None of this is giving me the warm fuzzies, but so far all the bad things you're describing are over there.
He pointed vaguely to the west.
I imagine you're about to tell me something that will make it relevant and so much worse.
The witch oracle had a vision.
Oh, goody. They always have visions. It's always vague and it's always bad. Just once I'd like a prophecy proclaiming that, without a doubt, everything is going to be fine.
I waited for him to get it off his chest. When I was in school, I was taught about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which in essence stated that the only way to determine the position and velocity of a subatomic particle was to hit it with another particle. You would know where the target particle was at the moment of collision, but the impact would change the course and speed of that target particle, and its new parameters would be unknown again. Prophecies functioned just like that. The very act of knowing what might happen altered the future in complex ways. That's why everything Sienna revealed was carefully calculated. Luther knew all that. He was just delaying the inevitable. Luther sighed dramatically and motioned to me.
Lay it on me. I have braced myself.
When magic crests at its peak, the King of Fire will leave his citadel of misery in the western desert and travel east to devour the queen who doesn't rule and sever bloodline reborn. Only the one who shares his power may oppose him.
Luther blinked. Moloch is going to kill Kate during a flare.
Yes, they meet. Kate dies. The world burns and becomes darkness.
That is oddly specific for Sienna.
It was a very vivid vision. She had to be sedated afterward.
The future isn't definite, and Sienna sees the most likely probability, Luther thought out loud. Are there other probabilities where Kate survives?
So far, all of her visions have been the same. If Kate comes into contact with Malik in any way, they fight, she loses, he kills her. If I come into direct contact with Kate, the vision becomes sharper and clearer.
You meeting Kate in person makes her death more likely.
Yes.
Luther pondered me. A long moment passed.
How old is this prophecy?
4 years. And you've been trying to fight it and failed?
I nodded.
Malik's former divine nature is a significant factor, isn't it?
I nodded again.
That's what I thought.
Luther's gaze turned dark.
If he were just a human, there would be wiggle room. But he is an avatar, a god made flesh. This isn't just the most likely version of the future. This is a deity communicating its will and intent through time. This future is incredibly resistant to the change.
Yes. Luther looked at the ceiling. I could practically feel the gears turning in his mind.
Does he know of the prophecy?
He does. Sienna has touched his mind.
Risky. Why Kate?
He fears the Shinar. The family has repelled his invasions in the past. He worries about the reunification of Kate and Era. To his mind, each is a kingdom unto herself, and their reach will grow until he is trapped between them. Kate is an easier target than my grandmother.
A follow-up question. Why you?
I don't know. According to Sienna, I'm the wild card. Perhaps it's because I'm educated by Shinar, but the power of my bloodline is fundamentally different from theirs. He hasn't fought my ancestors. He doesn't know what I can do.
That seems thin to me.
Luther frowned. He drummed his fingers on the armrest of his chair and seemed to come to a decision.
So, you can't go home?
No. He leaned back and steepled the fingers of his hands.
Tell me how I can help you.
I explained the magical artifact, the guardian, and the Mavareem. This murder has the same MO as Pastor Haywood's. I need access and support.
That I can do. I will also keep this conversation to myself. Who else knows you are you?
My grandmother and Conlan? Kate and Curran haven't seen me since my face changed.
Good, he said. Let's try to keep it that way.
10. I sat inside Alicia Walton's office behind her desk. The door was open, and the light from the fey lanterns in the hallway drew a long rectangle across the floor. The rest of the room lay shrouded in gloom, and I sank into it, wrapping myself in it like it was a blanket. Luther and I had formed an alliance. I would keep him in the loop, and he would allow me unsupervised access to crime scenes I believed were connected. Then a woman from Biohazard had arrived and Luther had to go. PAD and Biohazard finished processing the scene and left too, taking the body with them. Only I remained, waiting. Malik's priests would come. The Mavareem were fanatically single-minded. It was just a matter of time. I had to get answers this time. The longer I spun my wheels, the greater was the likelihood that Malik would murder Kate. Every time I thought about it, my throat tried to clench itself into a fist. Magic tugged on me, and I sank into Turgon's vision. The eagle perched at the top of the oak across from the entrance to Bowden Hall. 3 people ran across the lawn toward the building, low and fast. 1 dashed to the entrance, and 2 others rounded the corner. I disconnected. Just what I needed right now. Faint sounds came from beyond the broken window. A light rustling of the hedge, a scrape against the stone. 3, 2, 1. Ascanio jumped through the open window and landed by the rug.
What? No combat roll? I asked.
He pivoted to me, his eyes flashing with a ruby glow as they caught the light from the hallway. For a moment he looked ready to pounce. Then he straightened, his expression nonchalant. You again. We keep meeting like this. It must be fate. Oh no, the return of Mr. Smooth. What is your interest in Pastor Haywood's murder? Ascanio picked up a chair, set it before the desk, flipping it around and saddled it, his arms resting on the chair's back. My interest is private. I may be persuaded to exchange information, but you don't have the authority to question me. And you don't have the authority to be here. Neither do you. I gave him a small smile. Actually, I do. Ascanio smiled back. Fine, I'll play. Says who? Luther Dillon, the assistant director of Biohazard. Ascanio rested his chin on his arms. If that's true, I'm intruding on your crime scene. What's your plan for removing me? Somehow he managed to make it sound suggestive. You're being tiresome. It's a personal failing. I was told I can also be invigorating under the right circumstances. I bet. Does the Beast Lord know you're here? This is a clan matter. He had Andrea's and Raphael's blessing and was confident that they would back him up if things went bad. Why does Clan Buddha care about these murders? You're still not trading. How about this? I'll tell you mine if you tell me yours. I gave him a theatrical sigh. You must think that your smile is charming. Is it not? You know what I see when you smile? Teeth. Teeth that can grow into big, scary fangs. We both know it's a threat. He pushed from the floor, and the chair rolled back with him in it. Do you feel less threatened now? Not really. Keep rolling. Out the door, down the hall, down the steps. He tilted his head to the side. He really was stunning, especially when he smiled like right now. Why don't you like me? He asked. You menaced me on the bridge, showed up uninvited to my house, made veiled threats, tried to bribe me, and now you are contaminating my crime scene. The bridge was a misunderstanding. I came to your house to apologize and offer help. And as for the crime scene, I was on this case before you were. He spread his arms, a picture of innocence. I'm blameless. I laughed. I couldn't help myself. It just came out. Ascanio leaned forward, feigning concern. You stopped scowling for a second there. Are you all right? I caught myself. I was about to say peachy, and the moment he heard it, the game would be up. It was my mom's favorite phrase. Perfectly fine. A warm sensation washed over me. My ears heard a phantom lamentation, offered in an eager voice. My nostrils caught the scent of burning herbs and human flesh. It should have been revolting, and intellectually it was, but there was a part of me that found it comforting. A very small, faint voice whispered in my mind, "This is right. You should be offered this. This is your due." The Mavarim had arrived. The lament echoed in my mind. My pulse sped up. I couldn't even sense the Mavir at the first murder scene until I had concentrated on the glyph. This one radiated magic. It pressed on me, like a heated wall, sucking out the air and making it hard to breathe. This would be an entirely different fight. I had to get Ascanio out of here. I couldn't let him get hurt. We are getting nowhere, he said. How about this? Each of us asks one question, and the other gives an honest answer. And then you leave. Deal. Ladies first. I leaned back in the chair. What advantage would you personally and or Clan Buddha gain if you tie this murder to Desandra Krall? The charming smile vanished. The man who rose smoothly out of the chair was lethal and dangerous. He stalked across the room, put both hands on the desk, and leaned forward. He glared at me, his eyes like two bloody rubies lit up by fire from within. It was a stare that said I was food. A cold shiver dashed down my spine. Ascanio was right before. When he threatened someone, they didn't have to ask. Suddenly, the office was too small, and I was acutely aware that I would have to get past him to reach the door. You made a deal. I kept my tone cold. Pay up or leave. The red light in his eyes grew brighter. His stare was difficult to hold. That's twice in one night. First Derek, now him. This time, I wouldn't be running. Seconds ticked past. Ascanio opened his mouth. His diction was perfect, but his voice was knitted from a growl.
Be very careful. You're playing a dangerous game.
That's not an answer.
It's free advice. You had trouble with one overgrown human. I won't go down that easy.
That was about enough. Any longer, and he would get dragged into the fight. I had to get him gone. That's not what I heard. He whipped around and leapt out of the window. The sudden emptiness was startling. I raised my chin. Showtime. We're alone now. Show yourself, worm. I don't have all night.
The darkness pooling in the corner of the room moved. It flowed from the ceiling, from the floor, to its center, as if a large piece of the thinnest black gauze had been spread over the far wall and the floor, and now someone caught it with a hook and was pulling it to me. I forced myself to sit still, my hand on the shaft of my spear. The darkness coalesced into a human shape, tall, lean, male, and woven of fire. Smoke swirled around him, transforming into a voluminous black robe and a long cloak. Human skin the color of alabaster sheathed him, obscuring the fire, but failing to hide it completely. It was still there, licking his skin from the inside and warming it with a soft peach glow here and there. Not just a Mavir, one of the high priests. Shit. At least I'd gotten Ascanio out of here. The Mavir folded his hands in front of him, left palm up, right resting on top of it. He was hairless. No stubble, no eyebrows, no eyelashes. Just smooth skin stretched tight over angular features. His eyes, a light bluish green, fixed me. There was no surprise in them, only recognition. He came here especially for me. The amount of magic he required to maintain a human form had to be staggering. I wasn't sure I would win this fight. The high priest gave me a shallow bow, little more than a nod.
We finally meet, Denanu.
What reason would I have to meet with a child killer? Leviticus 18:21 prohibited the faithful from sacrificing their children. The specific line stated, "And thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Moloch." The Mavarim received their name from that act. They were the ones who took living children and passed them through the fire to their god. One didn't become a high priest until he had murdered hundreds.
I've hidden well, yet you knew I was there. Tell me, Tananu, does my magic call to you? Does the sacrificial fire smell sweet? Does its power tempt you?
No, it sickens me.
Really?
He tilted his head like a puzzled dog.
I think it beckons you. It's a craving, a gnawing need that only sacrifice can satisfy. Imagine tasting it. Imagine the rush of power flooding through your throbbing veins.
Veins don't throb, arteries do.
Why deny yourself the ecstasy?
I don't know. The burning baby's alive part probably has something to do with it.
Life is pain and suffering, a nasty and brutish journey of toil and regret.
His magic pressed on me like a heavy weight. Thomas Hobbes called. He wants his thesis back.
Children are innocent and pure. We spare them a lifetime of misery. In a brief flash of pain, Their souls join our God in the glorious eternity of the afterlife.
How very noble. Your God feeds on suffering. The Mavir gave me a condescending smile.
All gods feed on suffering. Without it, there are no prayers or offerings. Mankind is selfish. They give only when they have to. If this world was idyllic and life was just, what need would there be for gods?
The more he talked, the higher the chance I had of learning why he was in Atlanta. But he was too high up on the food chain to let something slip unless I got him agitated. I had to bait him. The Christian God doesn't require blood sacrifice. The Mavir laughed softly.
Oh, but he did. Their God thirsted for blood. He demanded it. And when his ratings slipped, he hid behind a kinder, softer version of himself. How many died in that humble God's name? How many killed for the martyr? Firstborn sons were his favorite.
That's right. Keep ranting. And yet his followers flourish. The Mavir sneered.
The gullible who willingly swallow lies, and the blind who shut their own eyes for the fear they will see the truth. The cults of Abraham, the biggest con of the modern world.
How to insult Judaism, Christianity, and Islam in 3 sentences or less. Tell me, when I kill you, will you pass into the glorious eternity of the afterlife and bask in the love of your God? He smiled.
Eventually, when I die, yes. But it won't be today, and it won't be by your hand.
He was very sure of that. I leaned forward. One thing puzzles me. Perhaps you can clear it up, given your vast knowledge.
I shall do my best.
Those Abrahamic religions you sneer at chase your God out of the world, because nobody wants to sacrifice their children and their future to a rabid glutton eager for the next hit off the sacrificial altar. Since nobody knows who he is, Moloch is starving for followers and he had to be reborn. He became flesh. The Mavir stared at me. Hold on, I'm getting to it. So answer me this, High Priest. If I kill you now and you pass through the mortal veil, what will you find on the other side? Your glorious eternity is empty. Your God isn't there. He is in Arizona digging in the dirt. Your soul will float in nothing, lost and alone. Do you know what hell is? Hell is the absence of God. His face rippled. Ha, direct hit. I sank his battleship. The Mavir opened his mouth.
Say what you wish. Fight with everything you have. Struggle, kick, bite. None of it matters. He wants you, and you will come to him. You will dedicate yourself to him. And when that moment comes, you will beg to bring him your mother's head on a silver platter. You will weep tears of gratitude when he devours her eyes.
That's beautiful. You should write that down. If my journey is so inevitable, what are you doing here in Atlanta? Why not just wait for me?
He leaned forward, the flames inside him flaring. I will carve you into pieces and bring them to my God. The drop of power you stole will keep you alive. And when you awaken half a century from now in his fiery embrace, we will speak again. Fear hammered a cold spike through my heart.
I could see it in my head, my body in pieces, clinging to life, aware, watching, but powerless as everyone I cared about died one by one. I had to kill him. If he won, what kind of world would I wake up to?
The High Priest showed me his teeth, blood-red fangs made of fire. I can hear your heart flutter. I watched you walk around this city you used to call home, wearing pretend arrogance like armor. Now you understand. He is a god, and you are still an abandoned child craving approval and shivering in the dark. The fear crystallized into a new emotion, and I let it fuel me. Fear isn't the only thing that can make a heart flutter. What else is in your heart, orphan child? Rage. I spat power words, a command from a language so old it shaped magic itself. Sert ranam gere. Bar the city gates. Magic pulsed from me in a flash of blinding pain, splashing against the boundaries of the room and burst into an invisible wall, cutting us off from reality. My grandmother used this spell millennia ago when enemy armies besieged Shinar cities. The Mavir recoiled. I leapt over the desk, Dakan in my hands, and stabbed at the priest, aiming just under the breastbone. The spearhead shone with red as it sliced the air. I had brought two canteens full of vampire blood primed with my own. An hour ago, when I took up my post behind the desk, I had coated Dakan in the blood mix and solidified it, turning the metal spearhead into a razor-sharp blood weapon. The Mavir turned to smoke. The spear pierced him and passed through with no resistance. The swirl of smoke surged to the window and rammed the invisible magic wall, turning solid for a microsecond. The magic tolled in my head like a giant bell being struck with a hammer. I stabbed at him, and he went ethereal again. My spear had shredded smoke. The high priest streamed toward the door and slammed into my wall again. I thrust at him before the sound of the impact rolled through me. Dakan met only air. Missed again. Damn it. I couldn't stab smoke, and he couldn't break the wall unless he turned solid. Fine. I could keep this up until he got tired or I got lucky. We danced across the room, him throwing himself at the boundary and me trying to nail him with my spear to it. The world shrank to the clump of smoke and the tip of my spear. Where was the fire? Absorbing Moloch's eye granted me some immunity, but it had limits, and a high priest would burn through them in a single blast. Why wasn't this room a sea of fire? Using the language of power took a hefty chunk of my magic. I could hit him with another one. I had a whole arsenal at my disposal, but there was no guarantee it would work. He was holding back, and until I knew the full extent of his power, so would I. The blood spear would work just fine. Stab, stab, stab. My spear sliced through solid flesh. Fire splashed the magic wall, and then the Mavir was smoke again. Nicked him. I just had to be a hair faster. The smoke turned into fire. A glowing nebula of light and heat splayed out near the ceiling and contracted, like a star collapsing into a tiny, white-hot spark. It shot across the room like a bullet, shrinking into a blinding mote of light, and bit into my wall. A scalding hot needle of pain punctured my skull from one temple to the other and vanished. He was through. Shit. The fire exploded outside the window, snapping into the Mavir. I spun to the desk, dropping the wall as I moved, grabbed my bow, turned, and fired. It took less than half a second. The arrow tore through the Mavir and streaked into the night. No damage. The high priest laughed. Chase me, daughter of Shinar. Catch me. Drive me from your city. Try to take my life before I feast on the eyes of your loved ones. Show me what you can do. I let out a shrill whistle, swiped my spear off the desk, and ran downstairs. He dared me to chase him, which meant he had a trap prepared and would lead me to it. That was the plan all along, and I would follow him into the trap. I had no choice. He had seen Ascanio and probably Luther. If his rant wasn't a bluff, he might have seen others. Stella, Martin, Nick, my family. I had to kill him, no matter what it took. I burst out of the front doors. The Mavir hung above the lawn, 50 feet in the air. Too high. I unscrewed Dakan and slid its halves into its sheath on my back.
Tulip came running, and I sprinted to her and jumped into the saddle. Above us, the Mavir surged across the sky, an ink-black swirl of magic that blotted out the stars as it passed. Turgon took to the air, and I sent him high, out of the reach of the priest. I chased the shadow in the sky heading west. Tulip dashed through the deserted pre-dawn streets. The priest turned north. I made a left on Clifton. Tulip broke into a gallop. Buildings rushed past us. The smoke veered right to the northeast. Woods loomed in front of me, the entrance to the trail cutting through them illuminated by a single fail lantern street lamp. I steered Tulip onto it. The trail shied left, then right. Tulip took a turn too fast. Tree branches slapped me. I couldn't see him, but my magic told me he was still there, trailing spicy smoke and echoes of human weeping. The trees on the right ended, as if jerked out of sight. Asphalt replaced packed dirt. We galloped along a lake, Tulip's hoofbeats too loud on the paved ground. A shred of darkness streaked on the edge of my vision and disappeared beyond the trees ahead. I would kill him tonight. It was that, or my people would start dying. We reached a bridge and tore across it. The trail turned right, the trees parting like opened hands. A huge ruin loomed ahead, pale gray in the light of the dying moon. A sign flashed by, Atlanta VA Medical Center. The thing I was chasing hovered above it and dove down. This was it. I blinked into Turgon's vision. It was fuzzy and dark, but I saw the ruin from above. The roof was gone, but the outer walls and some of the inner ones still stood, jutting into the sky anywhere from 50 to 70 feet high, turning the abandoned building into an unpredictable labyrinth. The inside of the medical center had collapsed and was cleared, probably looted or salvaged. A spark ignited in the heart of the ruin, the Mavir making sure I didn't get lost. I dismounted. Tulip stared at me, wild-eyed, and I hugged her to me. If I don't come back, go to your mother. She knocked me with her head. I grabbed my bow off her saddle and ducked into the building. The air smelled of concrete powder, a dry, chalky scent that lingered in buildings chewed up by magic. Weeds grew through the crumbled floor, widening the cracks. Here and there, walls rose, distorted by the remnants of wiring and plumbing. I glided through it, quiet and fast. A slight breeze fanned my face, bringing a hint of smoke. Close now. I walked through an arched doorway. A big square room lay in front of me under the open sky. The floor was a memory, all grass punctuated by a tiled chunk here and there, but the walls were solid,